So back together again in the 11th chapter, the Yoga of Divine Works and the Synthesis of Yoga, the Master of the Work. When we closed last time, there was a wonderful phrase which suggests that we should be aware of our true nature, conscious portions of the one eternal and infinite, put out in herself for her works by the Supreme Shakti, Mahadevi, the Mahashakti. And of course, this is reminiscent of what we read in the Gita towards the close of the 18th chapter, and we read the pages from the mother in chapter 5, which closed out that section in the book to remind us where we were and why it is that we do work and what works through us. So Sri Aurobindo takes it further in this next section. There is another There is another greater step to be taken after the surrender of our instrumental ego to the divine Shakti. It is not enough to know her as the one cosmic force that moves us and all creatures on the planes of mind, life, and matter. For this is the lower nature. And although the divine knowledge, light, power are there concealed and at work in this ignorance, and can break partly its veil and manifest something of their true character, or descend from above and uplift these inferior workings, yet, even if we realize the One in a spiritualized mind, a spiritualized life movement, a spiritualized body consciousness, an imperfection remains in the dynamic parts. There is a stumbling response to the supreme power, a veil over the face of the divine, a constant mixture of the ignorance. It is only when we open to the divine Shakti and the truth of her force, which transcends this lower Prakriti, that we can be perfect instruments of her power and knowledge. So there is a subtle distinction here between the inner experience of the oneness with the Supreme Mother and the permission that our surrender gives to that mother power to work through us. The surrender, nati, submission, is what begins Sri Aurobindo's record of yoga in the Sapta Chatushtaya. In the Shanti Chatushtaya. But it is followed by much we note here that he says that the divine nature, all that is luminous, all that is powerful, all that is joyful, is concealed, embedded in, immanent in the cosmic force as we perceive and receive it. But this is the lower nature. It may be there, but something has to part the veil and permit the greater nature to stand forth. That has to be catalyzed by the conscious surrender of nature as she is to nature as she will be. And that is the agency of the soul working in nature. It is the mission of the soul as it evolves to awaken in seed-like form this greater possibility for the whole cosmos. So getting the inner realization of the omnipresent one and making that felt not simply in our awakened psychological parts, in our inner mind, for instance, but in our inner vital and in the interior experience of our body, it isn't enough. The realization is not enough. Something must come greater than that. Sri Aurobindo is writing this after decades of practice, pursuit through all the tangled ways of nature, trying to bring the supreme experiences available to him into the mesh of matter, through the mind, through the life force, into matter. And yet, as he says, an imperfection remains in the dynamic parts, a stumbling response, and he notes carefully in his record of yoga where he finds imperfection in his own being and is merciless in prosecuting the matter. But he knew from his own experience, and he knew from the faith that carried him forward, that it was not his work to achieve, but the Divine Mother's to achieve in him. What he had to offer was the enabling surrender and the absolute partnership, the collaboration with the Divine Force as it descended into him that achieved. So, we must get to that which transcends this lower Prakriti so that we can become perfect instruments. That means getting beyond that transversal line that separates this triplicity from that triplicity. So he continues, not only liberation, but perfection must be the aim of the Karma Yoga. So, this strikes a difference between Sri Aurobindo's position with respect to the scale of the work as opposed to the traditional paths which aim at releasing the psychological person from bondage to the attachment to ego, attachment to desire. If that is the entirety of the work, Sri Aurobindo's yoga was complete in the first 3 minutes of his concentration with Lele. But you can see, still, he's writing and revising the life divine and the synthesis of yoga as he learns more and more about the process of transformation, because simple liberation is not the challenge. It is not why the cosmos appeared, simply to erase it. The divine works through our nature and according to our nature. Again, we read that in the Mother. If our nature is imperfect, the work also will be imperfect, mixed, inadequate. Even it may be marred by gross errors, falsehoods, moral weaknesses, diverting influences. The work of the divine will be done in us even then, but according to our weakness, not according to the strength and purity of its source, that being the source. if ours were not an integral yoga, if we sought only the liberation of the self within us or the motionless existence of Purusha separated from Prakriti, this dynamic imperfection might not matter. Calm, untroubled, not depressed, not elated, refusing to accept the perfection or imperfection, fault or merit, sin or virtue as ours, perceiving that it is the modes of nature working in the field of her modes that make this mixture, we could withdraw into the silence of the spirit and, pure, untouched, witness only the workings of Prakriti. Well, this would be the goal of the shramana, the renunciation of the world, stepping back, letting it go. This seems to be, in fact, the early teaching that Krishna offers in the third book, Shloka 28, which is prior to the synthetic work that Krishna offers later, but says, yes, observe the modes of nature, realize you're not that, get free. A first step, not the final step. But, Sri Aurobindo is writing again, but in an integral realization, this can only be a step on the way, not our last resting place. For we aim at the divine realization not only in the immobility of the spirit, but also in the movement of nature. And this cannot be altogether until we can feel the presence and power of the divine in every step, motion, figure of our activities, in every turn of our will, in every thought, feeling, and impulse. No doubt, we can feel that in essence, even in the nature of the ignorance. But it is the divine power and presence in a disguise, a diminution, an inferior figure. Ours is a greater demand, that our nature shall be a power of the divine in the truth of the divine, in the light, in the force of the eternal self-conscient will, in the wideness of the sempiternal knowledge. And you've studied the life divine, and you know that when you see knowledge and will equated, he's speaking about the supramental consciousness, that which is above the mind and which is the original creative poise of the divine as it pours out its infinite richness from Satchitananda into self-sustained expression, manifesting the many but always within the one. After the removal of the veil of ego, the removal of the veil of nature and her inferior modes that govern our mind, life, and body. So first, the ego departs, and then one sees behind nature what is her truth. Ego being a construct of nature, if you're identified with it, you can't see the verities of what is moving nature because you're identified with a fractional position within it. As soon as you're free from ego, then you can see, ah. As soon as the limits of the ego begin to fade, we see how that veil is constituted and detect the action of cosmic nature in us. And in or behind cosmic nature, we sense the presence of the cosmic self and the dynamis of the world-pervading Ishvara. The master of the instrument stands behind all this working, and even within the working, there is his touch and the drive of a great guiding or disposing influence. So here is the Supreme, present in the universe and guiding the universe from within. The master of the instrument stands behind all this working, And even within the working, there is his touch and the drive of a great guiding or disposing influence. It is no longer ego or ego force that we serve. We obey the world master and his evolutionary impulse. So first, remove the veil of nature, and then perceive the master behind the work, and then enter into oneness and communion with the will of the divine. At each step, we can say in the language of the Sanskrit verse, "Even as I am appointed by thee, seated in my heart, so, O Lord, I act." But still, this action may be of two very different kinds, one only illumined, the other transformed and uplifted into a greater super nature. For we may keep on in the way of action upheld and followed by our nature, when by her and her illusion of egoism we were turned as if mounted on a machine, Gita 18:61. But now, with a perfect understanding of the mechanism and its utilization for his world purposes by the master of works whom we feel behind it. So, the illumination by climbing beyond that transversal line into identity with the supernature above, but then an action from that supernature proceeds. One lives no longer caught in the engine ring of Prakriti, but is directed by Paraprakriti, by the supernature. And so you see, he's taking us from the static realization of the self, from its peace, into the power of the self, its Atma Shakti. So he is bringing us here from the initial poise of the Shanti Chatushtayam into the dynamic poise of the Shakti Chatushtaya, going back to his record of yoga, for those who care to note it. So, this also is interesting, but now with a perfect understanding of the mechanism and its utilization. So this refers to the section in the Gita talking about the gunas, where the greater enlightenment gives you the keys to how to govern the cosmos. You begin to understand the principles of how the divine has arranged this world and can see the hidden levers. And at the divine's bidding, you may be asked to collaborate in the inaction. Inaction, not inaction, of his will. This is indeed as far as even many great yogis have reached on the levels of spiritualized mind. But it need not be so always, for there is a greater supramental possibility. It is possible to rise beyond spiritualized mind and to act spontaneously in the living presence of the original divine truth force of the Supreme Mother. Our motion, one with her motion and merged in it, our will, one with her will, our energy, absolved in her energy, we shall feel her working through us as the divine, manifest in the supreme wisdom power. And we shall be aware of the transformed mind, life, and body only as the channels of a supreme light and force beyond them, infallible in its steps because transcendent and total in its knowledge. So again, Sri Aurobindo is taking us out of the realm of the sheer inner experience into a dynamic poise. We first must, as he describes it here, realize the supramental and allow the chit shakti, the conscious power of the Divine Mother, to act through us. Our motion, one with her motion, will with her will, energy in her energy, etc. So this is consequent in all the parts of the being. It's what he's saying here. So the deha shakti, the prana shakti, the chitta shakti, the buddhi shakti, all of these powers of the nature come into full plenary demonstration. And again, he's identifying knowledge and will here. So he is speaking about the supramental consciousness as it descends. Of this light and force, we shall not only be the recipients, channels, instruments, but become a part of it in a supreme, uplifted, abiding experience. So we will be placed in terms of our center of being in the Paraprakriti. Our action will flow from that and displace but not arise in the divided nature of Prakriti. The higher nature will supplant the lower. So he is aiming here at siddhi, at transformation. Become a part of it in a supreme, uplifted, abiding experience. So the innerness of the experience is always there, yes, but it abides, it does not pass. Sri Aurobindo, of course, was very familiar with the seasons of yoga where you make a rapid advance into a new state of conscious being, only to find that something in the old nature calls you back, as if you have to sink to the old level and bring the riches of what you experience there down there and massage it into the earth somehow before you can be permitted to abide in the above. But Sri Aurobindo is speaking about it as a supreme, uplifted, abiding experience. We shall not only be the recipients, but become a part of it, which means that we collaborate with the higher nature. We co-share in what it throws into expression. We participate in its creation of a new world, because the old departs when the new reveals itself. Already, before we reach this last perfection, we can have the union with the divine in works in its extreme wideness, if not yet on its most luminous heights. For we perceive no longer merely nature or the modes of nature, but become conscious in our physical movements, in our nervous and vital reactions, in our mental workings of a force greater than body, mind, and life, which takes hold of our limited instruments and drives all their motion. So he's speaking here of all of this occurring as a realization at the cosmic level. There is no longer the sense of ourselves moving, thinking, or feeling, but of that moving, feeling, and thinking in us. This force that we feel is the universal force of the divine, which, veiled or unveiled, acting directly or permitting the use of its powers by beings in the cosmos, is the one energy that alone exists and alone makes universal or individual action possible. So this is the Divine Mother as Chit Shakti, the conscious power of the Supreme. For this force is the divine itself in the body of its power. All is that. Power of act, power of thought and knowledge, power of mastery and enjoyment, power of love. Conscious always and in everything, in ourselves and in others, of the master of works, possessing, inhabiting, enjoying through this force that is himself, becoming through it all existences and all happenings, we shall have arrived at the divine union through works and achieved by that fulfillment in works all that others have gained through absolute devotion or through pure knowledge. But there is still another step that calls us, an ascent out of this cosmic identity into the identity of the divine transcendence. So, a very bald statement that by perfection in works, one gets the fruit of the yoga of knowledge. One gets the fruit of the yoga of devotion and love. But there is another step which leads us into the identity with the divine transcendence, because here he was speaking about how this plays out in terms of its cosmicity. The master of our works and our being is not merely a Godhead here within us, nor is he merely a cosmic spirit or some kind of universal power. The world and the divine are not one and the same thing, as a certain kind of pantheistic thinking would like to believe. The world is an emanation. It depends upon something that manifests in it, but is not limited by it. The divine is not here alone. There is a beyond, an eternal transcendence. The individual being, also in its spiritual part, is not a formation in the cosmic existence. Our ego, our mind, our life, our body are that, but the immutable spirit, the imperishable soul in us, has come out of the transcendence. So, pantheism literally and simply equates the divine and the universe. That is not Sri Aurobindo's position. It is not the position of ancient Vedanta, which places the moving, evolving cosmos inside the conscious being of the infinite awareness of the Supreme. Isha, in Isha Upanishad, the Lord, holds all of this, all universes, because each of us is a universe, inside of a larger universe, all placed in his being. And when we renounce egoism, fractionalism, and can identify with his spirit, then we get the real bliss. Then we get the real joy that is inherent in the cosmos. The world is an emanation. That means it comes out of the radiance of the divine being. It depends. The word depends. It means it hangs from, literally. And our friend Bob Kleinman quoted from another writer when he suggested in his book, Four Faces of the Universe, that this is an image of the divine. That as if an earring hanging from, depending from the body of the Great One. That is the cosmos, that earring, that small thing seems so large to us because we're embedded within it. It is all our world. Hangs from this unseen being whom we can't directly perceive with our eyes, with our physical senses, but with which we are always connected. So the world is an emanation. It depends upon something that manifests in it, but is not limited by it. And this is the miracle that the Gita says through Krishna to Arjuna. Behold my nature. I am in all things. All things are in me, but I am not in them in a limited way. I am not finitized. My infinity is never abrogated. So that is the transcendence. It is ever here. It is an immanent reality, but does not lose its transcendence. So we're saturated by it. We're simmering in a divine sauce. The individual being is likewise not a formation of the externalities of nature, but its soul is cognate with the Supreme Soul. The instrument that it uses is of nature. So he draws a distinction between what is sublime in the soul and the instrument that serves as its pedestal. We, like that spark from that great central fire, like that ray from the immutable sun, seems always to be shining, but each ray comes out dynamically on its own with its particular mission. That is the nature of our soul. So he's carried us back to this mysterious conjunction of individuality within universality, and yet expressing the transcendence beyond both, the three terms of existence. And ultimately, in our psychological and daily experience, we must be able to hold all poises at once within ourselves. This is the ultimate objective, psychologically, in terms of the liberation possible, to the yogin, to the yogini, to be the transcendent as an individual in the moving universe. Moving from station to station, as called, following the auspicious path at the auspicious hour, Brahma Muhurta. I think we've come far enough. That's a good place to put a bookmark. And now, a section from Savitri. This is in Book One, the Book of Beginnings. Perhaps before reading from Savitri, I do want to say one thing. I know we are all in a most unusual circumstance across the globe. There was an occasion 2,500 years ago when a cluster of spiritual paths came into being. They were confronting enormous change in human societies. Those societies had become rich and affluent in the production of food. They had never had so much food, but in bringing agricultural methods to bear, they had released into the world unnamed, unknown diseases which were everywhere. The population was expanding exponentially. People were suffering and dying. And there was a turn away from affirmative life towards renunciation of life. This is where the Shramanic religions like Jainism and Buddhism came up so strongly. It took 1,000 years for what we call Brahmanism that evolved into Hinduism to, in a sense, take the bait and do something akin to it with renunciation orders associated with Shankaracharya's work, etc. Because until then, nobody involved in Vedic or Vedantic work renounced the world. The whole position was realize the wholeness of things. Realize the abundance of the spirit in the abundance of nature. Enjoy. First, you must know what you are, being free from ego and free from desire. Then you experience the delight of the divine. Do not let your life affirmative prospects be dimmed by this dark occasion in the world's history. We will get beyond this, but we will get beyond this into a place of felicity by living less from the gratification of our senses and more from the felicity of our souls. So it is up to the yogins in the world to lead the way, to be conscious warriors, to be filled with spiritual light, and to be fearless. Abhaya. The divine will carry us through darkness and light to greater light. To Savitri. This is Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, The Yoga of the Spirits, Freedom and Greatness. A will, a hope immense, now seized his heart. And to discern the superhuman's form, he raised his eyes to unseen spiritual heights, aspiring to bring down a greater world. The glory he had glimpsed must be his home. A brighter, heavenlier sun must soon illume this dusk room with its dark internal stare. The infant's soul in its small nursery school, mid objects meant for a lesson hardly learned, outgrow its early grammar of intellect and its imitation of earth nature's art, its earthly dialect to God language change, in living symbols study reality, and learn the logic of the infinite. The ideal must be nature's common truth, the body illumined with the indwelling God, the heart and mind feel one with all that is, a conscious soul live in a conscious world. As through a mist a sovereign peak is seen, the greatness of the eternal spirit appeared, exiled in a fragmented universe amid half-semblances of diviner things. These now could serve no more his regal turn. The immortal's pride refused the doom to live a miser of the scanty bargain made between our littleness and bounded hopes and the compassionate infinitudes. His height repelled the lowness of earth's state. A wideness discontented with its frame, resiled from poor assent to nature's terms, the harsh contract spurned, and the diminished lease. Only beginnings are accomplished here. Our base's matter seems alone complete, an absolute machine without a soul, or all seems a misfit of half-ideas, or we saddle with the vice of earthly form, a hurried, imperfect glimpse of heavenly things, guesses and travesties of celestial types. Here chaos sorts itself into a world, a brief formation drifting in the void, apings of knowledge, unfinished arcs of power, flamings of beauty into earthly shapes, love's broken reflexes of unity swim, fragment mirrorings of a floating sun. A packed assemblage of crude, tentative lives are pieced into a tessellated whole. There is no perfect answer to our hopes. There are blind, voiceless doors that have no key. Thought climbs in vain and brings a borrowed light, cheated by counterfeits sold to us in life's mart. Our hearts clutch at a forfeited heavenly bliss. There is provender for the mind's satiety. There are thrills of the flesh, but not the soul's desire. Here, even the highest rapture time can give is a mimicry of ungrasped beatitudes, a mutilated statue of ecstasy, a wounded happiness that cannot live, a brief felicity of mind or sense thrown by the world power to her body slave, or a simulacrum of enforced delight in the seraglios of ignorance. For all we have acquired soon loses worth. An old disvalued credit in time's bank, imperfection's check drawn on the inconscient. And in consequence dogs every effort made, and chaos waits on every cosmos formed. In each success a seed of failure lurks. He saw the doubtfulness of all things here, the incertitude of man's proud, confident thought, the transience of the achievements of his force. A thinking being in an unthinking world, an island in the sea of the unknown, he is a smallness trying to be great, an animal with some instincts of a god, his life a story too common to be told, his deeds a number summing up to naught, his consciousness a torch lit to be quenched, his hope a star above a cradle and grave. And yet, a greater destiny may be his, for the eternal spirit is his truth. He can recreate himself and all around, and fashion new the world in which he lives. He, ignorant, is the knower beyond time. He is the self above nature, above fate. Namaste, Jai Ma.